High culture meets high technology at the bleeding edge of the radical right. Majority Rights Radio.
Hello, James.
Can you hear me?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
All right. So, James, I'm calling you today because I want to do a thing with you.
That's kind of ambiguous.
Well, you know, it's about this Majority Rights Radio thing.
Well, that narrows it a bit.
Yeah. Well, see, I had an interview planned for today with you saw that post yesterday I did about the post on the oil drum that some guy put there because some other guy gave a presentation last year, and then the other guy like wrote it up and put the slides from the guy that did the presentation, and
I'm bored.
Okay. Look. Don't be that way, James. Look.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
Okay. Here's the thing. So, if you could look at the post of Majority Rights and the comment thread, declining marginal returns on investments and complexity, the thermodynamics of Olduvai, and we're going to have reference to that. And if you could bring up another tab, go to the oil drum and go to the post, Things Fall Apart, Complexity, Supply Chains, Infrastructure, and Collapse Revisited, and have those two tabs open. Well, I explain to you what happened. Okay, so this was a presentation, Things Fall Apart, by Dr. David Korowitz from FISTA. He may not really be a doctor. It's in dispute. And I thought it was really interesting, and I thought we had a really interesting discussion starting on Majority Rights about it. So I thought I would like to interview this guy that gave the presentation about, you know, his slides and his thinking about entropy and stuff. And I just want to read to you from the mail I got back from him when I had an interview request yesterday. He's like, "Dear Soren, that's fine. My contact details are below. Regards, David. David Korowitz, FISTA, Dublin, Ireland." So I called his telephone number when I got this message yesterday afternoon, but it turned out that, of course, it was like 10 o'clock at night in Ireland, and he was at a pub with his friends. But he was happy to hear from me, and we're going to talk today and do the interview. So then wasn't able to reach him today, but I did get an email from him, David Korowitz, to me. "Hi, Soren. I am presuming you are a Soren Renner of Majority Rights. If so, I would prefer not to contribute to your interview. I believe cultivating racial/religious antagonism is the last thing we need. Regards, David." He does spell it religious. So once again, we have this. This has happened to me before. You know, I can't get an interview with somebody. I didn't want to talk about politics with him. I wanted to talk about, you know, the life of the mind, entropy, stuff like that. And I was on my walk today. I was thinking about how disappointed I was not to get this interview. And I thought, what I need to do is think of someone who can pretend to be David Korowitz for the purposes of talking about these slides about entropy and whatnot. And, of course, you came to mind. So I'm not asking you to take on his political views, whatever they are, or even his views on collapse and its likely speed, but just, I want you to, like, go through these slides and the Majority Rights comment thread and just riff with me as if...
Okay.
Okay, all right.
As if I'd read them as if I knew his theory. Okay.
Yeah, well, I think you do. I mean, it's nothing new. Okay. Basically, it's like Joseph Tainter meets Richard Duncan, you know, in like 2010. So you're done with it. You're okay with that, huh?
Well, we'll try it.
Okay. Okay, let's go to slide 5 at the oil drum.
Okay.
Title page.
Slide 5.
No, yeah. That's the title page. Oh,
Thermodynamics of Civilization.
Yeah, but that's just the title page. No, we're looking at the next one. Slide 6, Far From Equilibrium, Thermodynamics.
Okay.
And it you can't really enlarge this very well. And Bernard cells. And I thought this was interesting. I hadn't seen it put exactly this way before. I've seen Bernard cells just in oil in a frying pan.
Yeah.
Have you?
Well, yeah, I mean, Bernard cells are any kind of convective liquid. I mean, that's under heat. So
you get these self-organizing. But then he has this neat little diagram of the the heat transfer. So if you look at A, there's no heat transfer. B, there's heat transfer, and it's going evenly through the whole liquid because the liquid isn't moving. And you see that slope. And then you see the picture C, and all the transport, all the conductive transport happens right at the edges. And in the middle, there's a straight line representing the convective transport. That's really, that's interesting because he's going to use this as an analogy for life and civilization if we go down to the next slides. Right?
Okay.
So we have, okay, the Bernard cell, that's an ordered phenomenon. It's interestingly ordered. You have these hexagonal cells of convection, and it's spontaneous order that arises. And so it's like life in that you look at it and think, that's a neat, that's a complicated phenomenon. But the point is, it arises because you have a flow of free energy through the system, and there's a gradient of free energy, and the structure arises because essentially the structure is just is parasitic upon the flow of energy.
Well, I think they call them dissipative structures.
Okay, right. All right. Okay. So Dr. Fake Korowitz, why don't you read a couple paragraphs there, in the universe through within the system there.
Oh, okay. In the universe as a whole, entropy or disorder is increasing. Yet life, our civilization, the things and institutions we create are ordered. We create islands of low entropy out of the tendency to universal disorder. To see this, we can look at the simple example of a Bernard cell. The molecules in the liquid between the hot and cold plate are moving randomly in all directions. Any one part of the liquid is the same as any other part. As we increase the temperature gradient, we arrive at a point where suddenly there appears lots of convection cells. This phase transition corresponds to the emergence of lots of order and structure within this system. While the cells themselves are low entropy, we see in the graph that the transition corresponds to a big increase in the rate at which heat is dissipated. Heat is the most disordered high entropy form of energy. The dissipation is into the environment outside the experiment. In general, locally ordered structures enhance the flow of general disorder, and so such structures are thermodynamically stable as long as there is a continuous flow of free energy through the system.
What happens if we reduce the flow of free energy that allows us to maintain the gradient below the critical threshold, though?
Well, there's clearly going to be some kind of convection going on somewhere because it just, you know, it's not going to, energy is just not like that.
This is from the next sentence beyond where you stopped reading.
Oh, okay.
What happens if we reduce the flow of free energy?
If we reduce the flow of free energy that allows us to maintain the gradient below the critical threshold,
what happens?
The order disappears.
Disappears? Oh, but what if it wanted to keep living? But it was so beautiful. Okay, so now let's think about what that means for our society. Let's skip the energy rate density a cosmic view and go to the thing about manufacturing processes.
Resources used in manufacturing processes. It is a cliche, though true, to say that life has become more complex. We can see this in the products we produce. This figure shows the energy used per unit mass graphed against process rate of various manufacturing processes. The processes range from manufacturing processes used half a century ago up to modern semiconductor and nanotechnology manufacture. What we see is that we are making much more energy-intensive products of much smaller size. The most modern commercial processes are forming distinctive structures on the scale of only tens of atoms. Let us take...
Let's just skim over that part. But the point is that we're now creating these tiny, intricate, Fabergé egg-like circuits which represent just huge amounts of free energy flow, but concentrated down into like these tiny, beautiful objects, right? But...
Well, of course. I mean, why would one assume that it would be anything but the highest energy consumption industry to fabricate semiconductors.
So what you're saying is that the thermodynamic reality is that the cost for higher complexity on smaller and smaller scales must be paid in increasing energetic material resources.
Yeah, that's my whole point. I'm speaking as what's-his-face
right
now, okay. Yeah, that's the whole point. I mean, you cannot have small structures made without large amounts of energy.
Wait, okay, now you're being tendentious. He wouldn't say that.
What do you mean he wouldn't say that?
Because of life. Obviously, life is a counterexample to that.
Well, I'm sorry. That's why I saw him say here.
Okay. Well, anyway.
Energy used per unit mass graphed against process rate of various manufacturing processes.
Okay. Well, anyway, let's get to the adaptive landscape because there was a question about that. So this is slide number 11. And let's skip over to the majority rights comment thread and find where somebody was talking about that.
Adaptive landscape.
So okay. Leon Haller, second comment, says, okay, I have not read the article and can't right now, but what in the world is the second illustration supposed to be about? Now, I think this is pretty funny, right? He hasn't read the article. He's not going to read the article, but he thinks that it's a pretty strange illustration and what's it about. So I posted a reply to that was merely a link to the Wikipedia article on Al Jaffe, who came up with the Mad Magazine feature, Snappy Answers to Stupid Questions.
Yeah.
And then notice when it said, it's supposed to impress you. Let's see. And PF says that figure is analytica porn. Something along the lines of, look how they modeled that relationship, two abstract variables that can only be visualized with an apparatus, plus how they change over time, modeled visually in 3D space. It takes 6 years of college just to parse this. Ooh la la, rock me Amadeus. Now, I find this to be very tendentious because, first of all, I don't see...
Everybody's being tendentious now.
Right. Look.
Okay.
Where's time represented in the adaptive landscape? I mean, that's the whole problem with it, right? So, I mean, I have lots to say about the idea of adaptive landscapes in general as an analogy, and especially in evolutionary biology. But the first thing I want to say is it's not clear at all that time is represented on any of these axes.
Well, no. I mean, the adaptive landscape is basically... Well, how can I explain this? If you have... For example, a neural net, if you just do an artificial neural network, what you're really training it to do is to learn a hyperdimensional landscape. It's really what you're asking it to do by rewarding and punishing it for various responses. And evolution is sort of like that. There is this sort of, you know, ideal that you can achieve in coevolution with others. In other words, that, you know, as you adapt and others adapt, the landscape changes because you have to coevolution.
Aha, yes. Thank you. This is what I really wanted to talk about, James.
Oh,
yeah,
okay.
No, because you see, I thought a lot about this adaptive landscape stuff back when I was doing philosophy of biology. And it seems to me, so one way it's presented in popular science is that evolution is like water running down a mountain. You know, there's a droplet of water, and it just follows the local gradient, you know, which, you know, in a way is sort of, you know, tautologically true. That is to say, local changes happen because they're favored at the place where they happen.
Yeah.
So they follow the gradient. But the reason it's a terrible analogy is that the landscape changes with the choices the droplet makes as it's running down the mountain. So you can't say that the mountain is the same shape from instant to instant.
Right.
Right? Because obviously there's all these, I mean, the adaptive environment for one organism or one species depends on other organisms and other species that are going through their own, you know, ensembles of changes at the same time. And so I think that just, you know, throwing up a graph of a surface, and then we have these intuitions about what it's like to find local minima or maxima on a surface. And I think these intuitions are almost completely non-helpful when we're thinking about, you know, either civilization collapse or biological evolution. But yeah. That's the reason I put it in there. Just, I mean, it's kind of a pretty picture, and you know, it's completely non-helpful. If anything, it makes the point he's making in his presentation less clear. Agree or disagree?
Well, it depends on what the purpose of this graph is. I'm not sure what it is he's trying to say.
Okay, go back to his presentation. And it, okay. Slide 11, analogy and adaptive landscape.
Okay. Yeah. We can look at an analogy of these processes. This figure shows us at a moment represented by the red triangle faced with choices in the XY plane. The problem, say, putting in renewable energy infrastructure has an energy and resource cost represented by the height of the mountain, represented by the cross here.
Let me interrupt you. I want you to go on reading, but I want to just point out that he has said at a moment.
Right. Right. Well,
the time axis is not even represented by any of the axes.
Right.
Okay. So that's a terribly, terribly, I mean, it just shows how flawed his thinking is about, and how flawed in general people think about adaptive landscapes is.
Well,
the time isn't even shown.
Yeah, that's a reasonable statement, I suppose. So, okay. Yeah, there. In fact, I think that, evolutionary dynamics is an entire field of study about this kind of thing.
Right. But anyway, read the next paragraph.
Okay. What we tend to concentrate upon is this cost. However, we must also consider the ground beneath our feet. This is the implied infrastructure, which includes all those things we take for granted but are essential to the project's completion. These might include the availability of a financial market, that supply chains work, that contracts can be enforced, that transportation systems work. Really, the list is endless. In total, our implied infrastructure is the accumulation of all the complex organization and infrastructure up to this point in time throughout global society, without which the project cannot succeed.
Read the next sentence.
While most concentrate upon the trip to the summit, the real problem is that the ground is about to crumble beneath our feet. So he's talking about the landscape changing.
Well, right. He is talking about that. And this is when it gets really interesting. Okay?
Okay.
So then he goes on to talk about supply change in slide 13.
Oh, I'm sorry. See, I was talking about the landscape changing, Soren.
No, you were. You were, and so was he, but I'm just saying.
Right. Well, I was being him. Okay, I have to figure out what his voice is and then go into that voice when I'm being him.
Well,
you want to act like him,
not
right?
Really. I just wanted to talk about this stuff. But
okay, we'll go ahead.
The point is, I think his intuitions about this stuff are pretty good. I just think that, you know, that slide makes it... If you try to think about what he's talking about and then look at the slide and try to figure out what it would be on the slide, it's horribly confusing. I mean...
Well, I don't know. I wasn't confused. But anyway, go ahead.
Okay. So this is when it gets interesting, right? So he goes to supply chains. Okay. So what is a supply chain? Just answer that for yourself, right?
A supply chain.
Supply chain.
Supply chain.
So this is like, you know, in industry, you know, like I buy widgets, widget type A, and then I assemble them with widget type B to form a vertical flummox. And
it's the mass flow of, it may be information flow that goes into producing something.
Right. And here's a point that one of the comments on the majority rights thread, one of the interesting comments, I think, elides and or demonstrates and that this part was elided in that the commenter's reading, because he specifically says that the important thing about the way the supply chains work in the current system is that you can substitute inside the chains, so they're robust in the sense that there's usually a change you can make from one component to another component, from one supplier to another supplier. One of the defining features is we can change suppliers for economic or other reasons. You know, we can substitute S or S prime. We can lose suppliers in the supply chain, and the market system allows us to find new ones easily. Indeed, the system's so efficient that many companies don't even have inventory and just, you know, go to just in time.
Right.
And the mistake is thinking that this robustness against certain or even many small disruptions is the same as global robustness. against black swan events. I think that obviously some of our commenters don't understand that.
Well, yeah, I think that some military analysts have addressed precisely what it takes to disrupt these kinds of systems at whatever different scales. John Robb has some stuff about scale-free networks and how much of the networks you have to disrupt to be able to get a collapse.
Right.
I mean, a rule of thumb was something like, 7%? If you can take out 7% of, you know, the infrastructure, then you can get it to collapse. And I don't know exactly what the math behind that is, but scale-free networks tend to be reasonably representative of what's going on with
urbanization. Well, you see why I picked you, of all people, for this radio experiment. Right?
Oh, okay.
I mean, obviously, this actually turns out to be something you're expert in.
No, I'm not expert. If I was expert, I'd know what John Robb's formulas were, and I could, you know, describe them to you, and I can't. I'm just like, you know, speaking
this is the mistake that many
oracularly.
People, this is
what
the
is
mistake that you make about the nature of radio.
Okay? Oh, okay.
Radio doesn't forbid you to engage in hand waving to cover up like empty places in your
ignorance.
Argument. No.
Okay.
No. Radio actually makes the hand waving invisible, so it's actually easier to cover up problems in your arguments.
Okay.
So Korowitz goes on and says, intuitively, it makes sense to say that more complex things have longer and deeper supply chains. They have more substitutable components. This is an error either in he made an error when he was talking, or the guy that wrote it down made an error. What he means is they have fewer substitutable components. That is, there are very few alternative suppliers of, say, advanced integrated circuits compared to, say, plastic molding or cardboard boxes.
As you get to an optimum, you're
right.
going to have fewer and fewer replications of very redundant systems because it just costs too much. You try to make the systems you have as reliable as possible.
Right, but efficiency and small scale robustness actually imply global fragility.
Yeah, the closer you get to an optimum, the more fragile you are. Unless you're actually dealing with an evolutionary system, okay? In an evolutionary system where you have, a gradient of assaults.
But civilization is not evolutionary. There's only one global system, and it's all
together. People. That's this is sort of one of the arguments that people have. The market slaves would say that it is evolutionary and it is therefore robust and optimum. Okay.
Back to philosophy of biology. I worked out this stuff back in the 90s when I was thinking about it. People have there's a lot of errors that people make in thinking about selection and systems.
Right.
And you can't. I was particularly interested in the philosophy of science of the immune system, and what people would say about like learning in the immune system, and comparing that to evolutionary biology. You know, there's learning in the immune system. It gets presented with antigens, certain other things develop, certain cells like are potentiated. And the problem with all this thinking is that if you think about how the immune system works, you realize that selection in the immune system, selection of certain cell lines, for instance,
right,
operating during biological time, during the life of an organism, that itself, that whole process was under a larger process of selection.
Right.
So it's a selective process embedded in a larger selective process. And there's simply no way to make a nice isomorphic analogy between the structure, a simple structure, and a simple structure embedded inside another isomorphic simple structure. I mean,
the danger is if you have growth that's too fast, then it's very likely that you're going to end up with all kinds of things that you didn't account for because you haven't had enough time to really test your systems that you're building further.
The point is, if we're building a global economy, there's only one. And if there's only one, then there is no selective process ensuring that, like, whatever happens, one global, you know, one global technical civilization will still survive, you know? There is only
right.
one.
Right.
So it's just because what I'm saying is people who put their faith in, oh, it's evolution, it's progress. I'm just saying people's analogical thinking is handicapped by their failure to really unpack the metaphors they're using and seeing exactly how they're using them. And
well, let me try to clarify it a little bit. What people will say is that the global marketplace is an ecosystem, okay? And ecosystems have these, you know, adaptive dynamics that allow you to claim there is some kind of stability in those ecosystems. The problem is, I mean, that's true, too, I mean, but the problem is that if you look at the actual amount of time that it takes to evolve a reasonably robust ecosystem, it is how many orders of magnitude longer than civilization has existed?
Well, right. Right, because...
Okay, well, I'm just trying to say is that if
in
you really
some
want
sense,
to have...
In some sense, right, species... If a species exists for a certain period of time without a lot of change, in some sense that represents an ecosystem that has come into some sort of equilibrium, right? I mean, there's free energy flowing through it, but there's some kind of equilibrium.
And it's been tested in all kinds of different ways over a long period
right.
of time.
Right, but what we're living in, there's no equilibrium here. It's changing too quickly.
Right.
It's a dynamic
system.
Yeah,
that's the problem. It's not an organically evolved kind of system. It's this thing that we sort of built
right.
and relied upon our own intelligence to try to design to whatever it is. But the thing is that we're doing that at the same time that we're trying to claim that the marketplace is this sort of organic evolutionary thing.
Right.
And I have something to say about political economy with respect to that, but that would take us pretty far afield into my agenda, my personal agendas, and we can want to stick with this, I think, right now.
Okay. Well, so then he goes on to talk about collapse.
Okay.
Go to slide 17. And this is where you see that he is kind of close to Richard Duncan on Old of I theory, even though he doesn't mention Old of I theory.
Okay.
Right? So what he agrees with Duncan that essentially when growth stops and reverses, that there will actually be a more rapid decline than you would think if you just, you know, made the bell curve. So he sees a cliff in the future, maybe. And then he talks about debt and everything. We don't want to talk about that. But
yeah.
So let's leave his presentation and go over to the majority rights thread, and we can just riff on that for a few minutes.
Okay.
Because let's see, we've been talking for... how long have we been talking for? I have no idea. You know?
No.
Well, it doesn't matter. Anyway, this is, I'm telling you, this is golden. This is good radio. Because last time I did radio, I had the best feedback I'd ever had. It was a show I did with Matt Parrott. I did no preparation. I bullied him unmercifully. And it was great. People were like, oh, it's like dropping in and listening to two friends talking over a beer. So then I realized, you know, let slip the dogs of intellectual aggression and lack of preparation.
So what's in the comment thread that we can riff on, whatever you want to call it?
Yeah. Do you understand how riffing works?
Well, it's improvisation, right?
Right.
Okay.
So, you know, Peter Brotzman doesn't sit there and, like, go to the saxophonist, okay, now... you've got to do this. No, he waves his hands and he expects something chaotic and brilliant. This is what I want from you.
Okay, well, I guess part of the problem here is that I think that there usually is somebody who's, you know, got a pretty good idea of what the theme is that you're trying to pursue.
The theme is my frustration because I was supposed to do a show today and the guy stood me up because supposedly I'm a hater, a notorious hater. You know?
Yeah.
And it just, you know, it makes me angry because, you know, all I wanted to do was to, like, get my, like, entropy talk on, you know?
Yeah. Well,
but really,
I don't.
You know, we're better off with each other. Or at least I'm better off with each other. I don't know about you.
Yeah, I don't. Well, it depends. Yeah, okay. Well, let's continue with the riff.
Well,
take it away, Soren.
Okay, the main thing I wanted was Matt Parrott's comment at 6:30 p.m. last night. You don't have to read the whole thing out loud, but he has this idea that, the fact that the Y2K bug didn't destroy civilization is a counterexample to the thought that it's like that we live in a fragile system.
What you say? What you're feeling to balance against this is that humans are designed with just the kind of creative problem solving and fuzzy logic talent necessary to serve as a counterpoint to the logical point that shit, which is
more
complex.
Let's
I'm sorry. *T*, which is more complex and contains more dependencies, more easily breaks down. A modern car is dramatically more complex than a Model T, and yet less likely to break down. The modern internet is more complex than ARPANET, yet less likely to break down. On some sort of abstract level, this is probably internally consistent. So that's the essence of his argument, right?
Right.
Okay, well, my answer to something like that, I didn't respond in here, is that we are dealing with life forms that aren't human.
Now that's a riff. Go on.
Well, I mean, you know, corporations, governments, these kinds of things are not simply things that we have engineered and have mastery of. They're their own beasts.
Ah, right.
And so, you know, they take off and they do things that are never intended by the people that are in them. The people that are in them are just components.
Right. Tie that in with the whole AI singularity thing that Kurzweil has been talking about.
I don't know why would you want to do that?
Well, I don't know. I mean, on the expressway, have you ever seen like in the opposite direction on the expressway, there's like some terrible accident, you know, like a semi-trailer has like collided with a cattle truck or something? And you have to look?
Okay.
It's like that.
Oh.
I think if you brought in the AI singularity into this argument, I think we'd get that kind of effect.
Okay. The AI singularity is basically you make something that is intelligent enough that it can produce something even more intelligent.
Right.
And we're presuming in the sense that humans are such intelligences. In other words, the humans can engineer an artificial intelligence that's more intelligent than humans. Hence, those artificial intelligences could take off and rapidly create hyperintelligences that very rapidly exceed anything that we can comprehend.
Right, but what happens if these hyperintelligences that we cannot comprehend?
Yeah.
What happens if they like fuse with these non-human entities that we already have?
Right, you get this stuff that's just basically. I mean, this is the problem I have with the whole you know friendly AI thing. We already have a problem with you know making intelligence friendly. Just look at the Jews.
Yeah.
Okay, I mean, so it's not like, and there we're not even talking about a corporation. I mean, a corporation really, you know, is kind of a dumb beast. It just does shit.
Or me.
I'm sorry, it does things. What?
Or me, or say you, for instance.
What are you talking about now?
I'm saying,
we're dumb?
No, I'm saying we're not.
Oh, okay.
People dislike us for it.
Oh, well. I suppose, but I'm making another point. I mean, the point that I'm trying to make is, you know, a lot of these group entities, like, you know, certain ethnic groups. I mean, as a group, Jews behave stupidly, okay? Individually, they have, you know, some reasonable intelligence. It's just that it's completely misapplied. And I shouldn't say completely, but, you know, there is this, you know, big negative, you know, side of the balance sheet. And, so yeah, we already have the you know friendly AI or the friendly intelligence problem in a major way fused with the corporations, and we just saw it play out in the recent financial debacle.
Okay. You're keeping a lot of plates in the air. I want you to try for one more. Just go to the comment that Jimmy Marr posted today at 2:57 a.m. And if you could read that and then try to integrate that into the argument. And I want to hear you refer to the AI singularity.
Okay. Jimmy Marr says, check with James Bowery about the dating service.
It's majority rights dating services we were discussing.
Oh, okay. His recent article, Anti-Semitic LBK Undead Blitz Megalithic France, indicates a possible awareness of the whereabouts of gullible 125 IQ co-eds with big bazooms. I wanted to inquire at the time, but was too shy. Well, exactly what angle do we want to take on this? There's a lot of stuff. Oh, okay.
First of all, is that even appropriate language for MR? I mean, we're trying to have a high culture meets high technology.
Yeah, I understand, but there are times.
Does bazooms fit into that?
Well, it does when you're trying to sort of illustrate the actual mindset of guys like Lewontin and Gould and Harvard.
Okay, but how about bosoms, for instance? That would be okay.
No, because they don't think about them as bosoms. These are shiksas. You know, they're like, you know, subhuman sex objects.
Right.
And, you know, they may have 125 IQ, but that's just, you know, something that you deal with by creating pseudoscience in Harvard. And like right. getting publishers to publish your stuff in big tomes and having lots of people review it positively, and then you go to parties and you get laid. That's what they do. That's their
right.
That's their point of their existence. That's to what end they apply their intelligence as individual Jews. Okay.
Ah.
And so I'm just simply that was what I was alluding to.
Okay. Oh, he took that phrase from you? Okay. I didn't. I guess I missed it. I skimmed your post, but okay. All right. Okay. All right. Now it's your turn. I want you to finish this off. This has been almost a perfect radio show, but I need you to finish it off to cap it off with the perfect coda. And I'm not able to do this on my own. I need this to come from you. Say something great.
Something great. I guess we'll say something great about the current topic somehow, right?
No, wait. I thought of a topic. Glenn Beck has this thing tomorrow.
Okay.
You know, on the mall. You know,
yeah.
In Washington, D.C. Have you heard about this?
Vaguely.
And the leftists are all like, you know, very agitated because he's doing it on the anniversary of some speech by Martin Luther King.
Yeah.
So, do you have anything to say about that?
Well, I guess the thing that I would say about that is after a collapse, how long would Glenn Beck stay alive if he ran around demagoguing the way he does? For that matter, how long would any of the leftists stay alive if they ran around demagoguing the way they are?
Well, I guess that I'm not going to bring up the reptilians here, but
yeah. Well, I'm just saying that, you know, there is a stable point to which things collapse, and that is the point at which human communication is actually an evolutionary advantage as opposed to manipulation of word smells to get 125 IQ co-eds with big what do you want to call it?
Big bosoms
into bed in Harvard. So at that point, then all these guys are basically toast, and we can look forward to that day.
Thank you, James Bowery.
You bet.